We'll turn to Genesis chapter 48. We're going to talk about somebody who's not a teenager today. In fact, he's a man who's about ready to die and who is looking back over his life. We've been studying Joseph's life, and as you know, Joseph was sold as a slave into Egypt, and as a result of that, rose to be prime minister of Egypt. He was able to deliver his entire family. His entire family finally came down into Egypt, and while they're there, enjoying the blessings that God has provided them there, Joseph's father, Jacob, is 140-something years old and has just about seen the last of it, and he is having his last conversation with Joseph, and as he does, he talks about some of the key things that it caused his life to be what they are. And I'd like for us to read just the first 16 verses of this of this chapter, and then we'll look at those things. Sometime later, Joseph was told, "Your father is ill." So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, along with him. When Jacob was told, "Your son Joseph has come," Israel rallied his strength, and he sat up in bed. Jacob said to Joseph, this is one of the events now that he comes to his memory. "God Almighty appeared to me in Luz, in the land of Canaan, and there he blessed me and said to me, 'I'm going to make you fruitful and will increase your numbers. I will make you a community of people and give this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you.' Now then, your two sons born to you in Egypt before I came to you here will be reckoned as mine." Now what he's saying here is that Joseph's two sons are going to be two of the 12 tribes of Israel. There is no tribe of Joseph, there's a tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh. And then Levi was not going to have a tribe because that was going to be the priestly tribe. "Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine, just as Reuben and Simeon are mine. Any children born to you after them will be yours. In the territory they inherit, they will be reckoned under the names of their brothers." Now he talks about the second event, really important event in his life. "As I was returning from Paddan, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan." Now, Rachel was his lovely wife, his beloved. "She died in the land of Canaan while we were still on the way, a little distant from Ephrath." Ephrath is what is now Bethlehem. "So I buried her there beside the road to Ephrath. When Israel saw the sons of Joseph, he asked, 'Who are these?'" Now, here's an old man who's almost blind, and he's looking at his grandsons now. "They are the sons that God has given me here," Joseph said to his father. Then Israel said, "Bring them to me so that I may bless them." Now Israel's eyes were failing because of old age, and he could hardly see. So Joseph brought his sons close to him, and the father kissed them and embraced them. Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face again, and now God has allowed me to see your children also." Then Joseph removed them from Israel's knees, bowed down with his face to the ground, and Joseph took both of them, Ephraim on his right toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh on his left toward Israel's right hand, and brought them close to him. But Israel reached out his right hand and put it on Ephraim's head, though he was the youngest, and crossed his arms and put his left hand on Manasseh's head, even though Manasseh was his firstborn. Let me pause to say, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this particular part of the passage, but what he's lined them up so that the right hand will bless the oldest and the left hand will bless the youngest. The right hand had double portion and so forth. But he crossed his hands and blessed them, the youngest, with the right hand. And Joseph said, no, you're not supposed to do it. Now he said, I know exactly what I'm doing. The lesson behind that, of course, is that God can do it his way. He didn't have to follow the customs that we set aside. And of course, Jacob was the youngest, and he received the blessing also. This is following along. Nevertheless, that is what happens in that portion. Then he blessed Joseph and said, "May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been the shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys." Now in the process of saying this blessing, he's mentioned the third issue. The angel who delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. And he identifies that angel as God. "May they be called by my name and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they increase greatly upon the earth. When you stop to look at your life, have you asked yourself, why do I do what I do? What are the driving forces in my life? What is it that determines what the good things are that I accomplish? Or perhaps more important, what is it is accomplished that God evaluates as good? What makes that happen in my life? Now, the New Testament tells us that one day, every believer is going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And at the judgment seat of Christ, all of our lives will be evaluated and will be rewarded according to what is done in our lives, what God has done. And the measuring stick will be faithfulness. Now, there won't be any unbelievers at the judgment seat of Christ. It's only believers. Unbelievers will stand before the great white throne, and there won't be any believers there. And that'll be a whole different kind of judgment. But this is an evaluation and a rewarding of believers according to those really significant things that God has accomplished in our lives. When we stand at that time and God is evaluating Jim Bruton and each of you, we stand there and our lives are weighed and evaluated according to His value scale, it's going to be obvious what those things were in our lives that were the driving forces that caused our lives to be either very valuable or very worthless, maybe in some situations. What brought that about? Now, with this in mind, since that's going to happen, we know it's going to happen, and I'd rather not be quite so embarrassing, why don't we just evaluate now and do something about it? Well, Joseph, as he stood beside his dad's bed, and they're having their last conversation, Jacob is talking about the key events of his life. What the driving forces were that made his life what it was. He wasn't being pedantic about it. In fact, he didn't even really understand why his life had been such a mess, because there had been a lot of mess in his life. But the events were so dominant in his life that when he opened his mouth, they just came out. It was a normal thing to talk about because it was so powerful. Now, hopefully, as we look and we want to examine these three specific events that he brings up, because that may help us evaluate the powerful things that are in our lives that are moving towards very good things or not such good things. The first thing is that the most important asset in our lives, we will learn this, the most important asset in our life is the promises that God makes to us. Now, we'll look and see how Jacob discovered that in his life. But first of all, Jesus Christ kind of laid the foundation for this in something we're quite familiar with. You remember he said, if you hear my word and you build your life on my word, you're going to be like the wise man who built his house on a rock. Rains came, the floods swelled in, the winds blew. It stood. Built on a rock. If you don't build your life on my word, you're going to be like the foolish man who built his house on the sand. And then the rains came, and the floods swelled, and the wind blew, and great crash. If you build your house on the sand, it really doesn't matter what you build it out of. It's not going to last. In fact, the better you build it, the harder it's going to crash. Because good material usually is a little heavier than bad material. On the other hand, if you build your house on a rock, it matters a great deal how you build it, because it's going to last. It's going to endure. And you'll see what it's all about. So Jesus said, the only thing that's really worth building your life on is the truth, the faithfulness, and the security that's in His Word. You can bank on it. It's not going to fail you. Whatever you build is going to stand. Now, the foundation of Jacob's security was in not simply a general promise of God, but a very personal promise that God made to him. The situation was this. Jacob's brother Esau had threatened to kill him. He didn't like what Jacob had done. Jacob had kind of tricked him out of his birthright. And he said, as soon as Dad dies, I'm going to kill that buzzard. And Jacob got the word, and so he took off, running for his life. That night he arrived at Bethel, and he laid down to sleep. He pulled up a stone as a pillow. Not sure that's what I would want for a pillow, but he pulled up a stone, and he had a dream. And the dream is what we sometimes sing about when we sing, "We are climbing Jacob's ladder." Well, it really wasn't a ladder like we know it in the dream. It was like a staircase. And we know that it was probably made out of stone because all the staircases in those days would have been made of stone. So there he is standing at the bottom of this huge staircase that moves up into heaven, goes right up, and standing at the top of the staircase is God. And going up and down the staircase are angels. And God speaks to him on a very personal basis. And what he does is he gives Jacob the same promise that he had initially given to Abraham and later repeated to his father Isaac. Now it's being personalized to Jacob. It's one thing for your parents, young people, it's one thing for your parents to tell you what a wonderful thing Christian life is and how great it is to have the Lord in your life. And for your Christian friends to tell you what a wonderful thing it is to pray and have. It's a whole nother story when God deals with you on a personal level. When you find out what it is to have fellowship with God, when you find out this for joy in your heart, when you find out what it means to depend upon Him and to trust Him and to find that He comes through, it revolutionizes everything. This was Jacob's first personal encounter with God. And it should have been tremendously encouraging. It should have stimulated and motivated a walk with the Lord like you wouldn't believe. But it didn't. It didn't work that way. I mean, the impact simply was not there. And the question is, why? Why would a man have that kind of encounter with God and nothing? Well, the mystery is not too dark and difficult if you simply compare what it was that Jacob latched onto and compared with what God really said. For instance, Jacob focused on this. He said, God blessed me. This is verse 3 and 4. He blessed me and he said, I'm going to make you fruitful. I will increase your numbers. I will make you a community of people and I will give you this land as an everlasting possession for your descendants after you. In other words, God had decided to make Jacob and his family very special. He was going to give them a special place. He was going to take care of them. Everything was going to be great. That's pretty good, right? How can you get better than that? One problem. Totally self-centered. It's absolutely me-ism. What God can do for me, what God will answer for me, how God will bless me. There is nothing that gives purpose for a person's existence in that. There is nothing that will give significance to your life, meaning, direction, just by saying, isn't it wonderful? God is going to bless me and my family and we're just going to have, it's going to be so wonderful. You will die on the vine with those kinds of blessings. It won't work. Here's the part that he forgot. This was in the same promise. He did promise that he would give him a place. And he said this, I will spread you out to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south, and all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you. I will watch over you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. You see the difference? I will use you to touch the lives of everybody in this world. Now that's the kind of promise, that's the kind of challenge that'll mobilize everything within you. I mean, you say to me, you and your family will touch everybody in this world. I say, I don't believe that. If I believe that, that's going to change my life. See, that's worth living for. That's worth dying for. That's worth sacrificing for. I mean, that gives direction and meaning to your life. And God said, and I'll be with you every step of the way. And I'll guarantee the return on the package. It's going to happen. But see, he forgot about that part. All he remembered was, God is going to bless me and my family and give us a nice cozy place to stay. You and I have the same God that Jacob did. He'd make exactly the same promise to us that he made to him. But not far off, he did say to you and to me, the things, you remember the Lord Jesus said to his disciples, the things that I've done, you'll do greater. He says to us, I will use you to touch the lives of people for eternity, forever. They will be changed. And most of us miss this for exactly the same reason that Jacob missed it. We miss it because we read the scripture and we listen and we hear it, and then we select out and claim those promises that fit our chosen lifestyle. Whatever it is that's going to make me feel good and make me comfortable, that's what I want God to do for me, and that's what I'm going to pray for, and that's what I'm going to claim. And it doesn't work because God refuses to bless self-centeredness. You see, the joy of the life is a byproduct. It's the product of sharing God's life and vision and purpose and letting Him use you and change you and make you what He wants you to be. And when it happens, your life is meaningful and joyful and just can't be improved on. But most of us miss it because the promises of God really aren't the driving force in our life. We select out some promises, but they don't drive. They don't do anything because we're selfish. Now, again, if we evaluate the important things in our lives, and as we look at Jacob, we can discover that it's possible for the most dangerous enemy in our lives to be our own misplaced affection. Jacob was sitting there talking to Joseph, and as his memories were kind of pouring out, the second major event of his life came to life. It just bounced out. It didn't have any context. There was no reason to say anything about it. It was just, by the way. And he talks about a grief that clamped onto his life and never faded away. He said this in verse 7. As I was returning from Paddan, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan while we were still on the way a little distance from Ephrath. So I buried her beside the road to Ephrathah, to Bethlehem. Jacob's whole life, it seems, was filled with grief. And all the memories of grief in his life seemed to be boiled down and expressed in this one event. This one great sorrow that he lost his beloved Rachel. I mean, to watch her die on the roadside in the Judean wilderness as she gives birth to her second child, and to have to bury her there in the wilderness and leave her, he couldn't handle it. He never got over it. Now, it's possible to have a grief in our life that's so big that we just never let it go, and it dominates our lives from then on. And that's what happened with him. All of this began, by the way, with a romance that was never satisfied. Curious thing that a life of grief should begin with a romance that was not satisfying. Now, if you read the story of Jacob and Rachel, it's a wonderful romance novel. Except it was true. If you look at it closely, it ruins some of the romance, though. And I'm going to dare to do that. First of all, when Jacob saw Rachel, he fell head over heels in love with her. It was definitely love at first sight. By the time that he had known her 30 days or less, he had already covenanted with her father to work for 7 hard years in order to be able to marry her. And her father was a hard, harsh man, very demanding. So he's already made that kind of a commitment when he hardly knows who she is. Now, then something dreadful took place. And we don't know the details of how it worked out. As you read it, it's almost impossible to believe, but it tells you how crafty this man Laban was. He was so crafty that he was able to pull off a wedding feast and have Jacob heading toward Rachel, but when they went into the marriage tent, of course they didn't have electric light, when they went into the marriage tent, he put in the older sister, Leah. And it wasn't until he woke up in the morning that he realized that he had consummated his marriage with the older sister. He was not real happy at that time. This was not the greatest day of his life. But this was just the beginning of an extremely mixed up family. What Jacob did was he immediately tried to make up the difference. I mean, he'd been tricked. He'd been done really wrong. But he's going to make up the difference because he was going to have it his way. And so, he agreed to Laban to work another 7 years if he could go ahead and marry Rachel now too. And he said, well, you'll have to wait a week to finish this marriage ceremony and then we'll do that because, after all, what he wanted was 7 more years of work out of this guy. It makes for a wonderful romance story because he talks about, and the 7 years were as nothing, you know, because of his love for her. The problem is, the Bible never sanctions polygamy. In the beginning, God created man for woman, for one man to have one woman. He would leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two should become one. That was the model. Now, after that, the people of God picked up the ways of the world, and they had more than one wife. And God really doesn't come down on that hard until you get into the New Testament. He's very plain about it. But for some reason, he doesn't deal with that particular issue as you go through. But it was never okay. And it never worked. To give you an illustration, you are somewhat familiar with the conflict, the ongoing conflict between the Arabs and the Israelis. It's always been there, and it always will be there. And the reason is because Abraham had 2 bedmates. Out of one of them came the Israelis, and out of the other one came the Arabs, and they've never ceased to beat each other's throats. And if Abraham had just been faithful to one wife, we wouldn't have all that problem. But we do. It works that way in our personal life. When we're not faithful in the way that we should. Now, you know that when you tell a lie, sometimes to cover up that lie, you have to tell another lie. And then to cover up that lie, you have to tell another lie. A lot of sin works that way. One sin has to cover up another sin. That's the way it worked with Jacob's sin. He never loved Leah. He never satisfied the longings of her heart. He never let her know that she was special. And Rachel was insanely jealous of Leah, even though she was a favorite, because Leah had children. Leah was able to have children, and Rachel wasn't. So insane jealousy between the two sisters, which was then further complicated by the fact that Rachel decided, well, I am going to have my way, I am going to have children, and if I can't have them, you can have my handmaiden, and she will have children for me. So that made 3 women in the tent. And Leah said, well, I've kind of stopped bearing children too, and if Rachel's going to... So then there was now 4 women in the tent. This is not a real happy camp. It doesn't work too well. It's not supposed to work too well. Not to mention the conflict between the children. And all the favoritism that went with that. Well, let me tell you this. If you roll the clock back, so when Jacob first got to Paddan, and he sees this beautiful gal, if he stops to say, God, is this really your selection for me? You know what he would have found out? He would have found out that the promise that was made to Abraham and passed down to Isaac and then passed to Jacob was going to pass on through Leah's fourth son, Judah. And through the tribe of Judah was going to come Jesus Christ. Now, he wouldn't have found out all that information in detail. But what he would have found out that in the providence of God, even though it was some chicanery going on with father-in-law, Leah was God's choice. And getting Rachel did not make things happy. There was grief from then on. Sometimes that which seems very, very right because it is so desirable can bring a great deal of grief and pain in our life. And it dominated his life from then on. One example, for instance, is in Joseph's life. Now, we know that God planned for Joseph to be in Egypt, for him to rise to power, and for him to be the one who was going to deliver the whole family and the nation out of starvation until when they would come to Egypt. But the process by which it happened, all the hatred and the violence and the anger and everything that went into the conflict between the brothers that had them sell him off into slavery, you know where that came from? It came because Jacob was showing favoritism to Rachel's oldest boy. It all comes back. You know, one thing produces another thing, and it never quite gets right. Our affections, when they're not governed by, when they're not expressed within the will of God, are going to lead us to trouble, and they're going to give us grief. And the grief can dominate our life. And Jacob found out that if he wanted to look at what one of the great forces in his life was, it was not the promises of God. He passed up on that for selfishness. It was grief. His life was driven and dominated by grief because he let his own affections go in the directions that he wanted to, and that ruled his life. Well, there was a third thing that he talked about, and he just kind of briefly mentioned it as he's giving a blessing to these boys. But one of the things that we find out is, sometimes before God can really use us freely, he has to break us. I know, that just sounds terrible. It sounds like an awful thing, and God can't be that sadistic. But what it goes back to is simply this. To be usable in God's hand, you have to be moldable. God will not use a vessel that he has not personally molded and fitted and prepared to do exactly what he wants it to do. And so if he's going to use us, he wants to mold and shape and fit our lives to be what he wants us to be so that he can. And if we won't let him do that, he's not going to use us. In spiritual terms, what happens is the moldable quality in our lives is brought on by humility. When we see ourselves as only what God makes us, the hardness and the unbending qualities in our life come from self-will and pride. And that says, no, God, I know what I want. I know what's best. I am somebody and I don't want to be changed because I have it figured out. And at that point, we're either going to be unusable or he's going to have to break that hardness. Humility always comes before power. Peter said it this way. Clothe yourselves in humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, and he will lift you up in due time. He really wants to lift us up and use us in a very special way, but he can't if the pride is in the way. And Jacob had to learn this the hard way. After Jacob had worked 14 years for his first two wives, he then worked 6 more years in order to gain some properties. And God blessed him in such a way that he walked out of there a very wealthy man. Everything that he touched prospered. And he comes away a very wealthy man, very powerful. You know what goes with power and wealth? Usually, pride and arrogance. So here is a wealthy, powerful, proud man going back home, but he's afraid. Because, do you remember why he left? Esau was going to kill him. And Esau was a tough guy, and Jacob had more finesse. Okay? And he knew if Esau wanted to crush him, he could do it. And so he was afraid. And so he needed some help from God. Do you know how a proud man prays? A proud man prays by saying, I deserve it. I have the right to it. I'm a special person. God, please get with it. I mean, how many times have you said, God, where are you? I need you. You know, like this. Snap to. I've called on you. Please come. What is the attitude there? I have a right to this. I mean, after all, I prayed. Wonderful. So what? Well, I said the right word. So what? So here's a proud man needing help from God, and how is he going to do it? How is God going to be able to help him? Well, God is going to have to break that hard pride. That's exactly what happened. And God, you know, God sometimes does things in a very interesting way, very dramatic ways. And he did it in a most dramatic way in this situation. Let me read what happens. And this is out of chapter 32 where God, the point is God usually when he breaks it in the very strongest point, not the weakest point. Here's the story. This is part of it. Jacob was left alone. A man wrestled with him till daybreak. And when the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip. And the hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. And the man said, let me go, for it's daybreak. And Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Here's what happened. That night, in order to dramatize the situation for Jacob and for us, he clothed himself in humanity, much as he clothed himself in humanity in the birth of Christ. Here is God pre-incarnate. He has come in the flesh, and he's functioning as a man with Jacob. And Jacob finds the man, and he wrestles with him, and he recognizes this man can answer his problem. He can give him the kind of blessing that he needs. So he recognizes this is deity. And there's a wrestling match between Jacob and God. And Jacob is so stubborn, it says God can't break through. And so what he did was, he touched him in the place of strength and leverage in his body. He broke his hip. He wrenched it out of his socket. He said, ooh, that's painful, that's terrible. Yes, it is. When you get broken at the strongest point, it is very painful. And what happened at that point is, since his strength was broken, he could no longer really wrestle. At that point, he was a weak man, and all he could do was hang on. And at that point, he hung on, and he said, I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me. Now, the prayer, the wrestling match, the prayer changes from, I deserve it, I'm strong, you should do what I say, to, all I can do is hang on, but I'm not going to let go. It changed to tenacity. It changed to desire. It changed to humility, but courage and hanging on, and the result was God blessed him. But Jacob walked with a limp for the rest of his life. And the reason he walked with a limp was God wanted to know where his strength is. You want to know where your strength is? It's in becoming weak. It's in the breaking of your strong point where your strong will and your pride control your life. And if that breaks, God can bless you. He can use you. He can. If he has to break, you may walk with a limp. But the limp will be a blessing. Well, Jacob discovered that. And now in this last time, as Jacob is reflecting on the things that God has done, he describes God. And he uses two really interesting descriptions. First of all, he said, God is the one who has been my shepherd all the days of my life. And you know what a shepherd does? The shepherd does whatever is good for the sheep. It doesn't matter what it costs the sheep, and it doesn't matter what it costs the shepherd, he does this. This reminds you of the story of the shepherd whose sheep kept running off and kept getting himself in danger, and he knew that if he didn't stop it, the sheep was going to be destroyed. And so he breaks his leg, so he can't run off. Also, so he has to carry him. So there'll be a bonding of a relationship there, and a dependence that develops so the sheep will learn not to run off, but to trust and to walk with the shepherd. That's exactly what he's doing with Jacob here. The other way that he identified God, he calls him the angel who delivered me from all harm. This is the angel that he wrestled with. Well, he's identifying that wrestling match as delivering him from all harm. How did that happen? I don't know the details. All I know is that now, looking back, Jacob is able to realize, when God did that for me, he saved my life. When God did that for me, he kept me from getting myself in places where I would have been killed. I would have destroyed my life, and he kept me from doing it. That's growth and maturity. That's wisdom that we all have to wait till we're on the deathbed to get. See, that's the reason we want to look and learn from Jacob, so we don't have to learn it in the latter years of our life. We can learn it right now by looking at what's happening in our lives. So the question is this. Why do you do what you do? What are the driving forces in your life that push you toward the kinds of things that you're doing? What molds your behavior? What motivates you? What mobilizes your energy? There's some things there that are very, very important in your life, and you haven't identified them as important. And you haven't evaluated the value. You haven't really looked to see what's needed. Let me ask you this. Is the promise of God? It wasn't for Jacob, and Jacob received a wonderful promise. But he molded the promise to fit his lifestyle, his desired lifestyle. And if the promise of God doesn't motivate you, if what God can do in your life and molding you and making you and using you, if that's not motivating you, forget about your religion. It's just a convenience. It's just something you just to make you feel good. It's not the real article. How about your own affections? Is that what drives your life? Are your affections directed and gauged and given purpose by the will of God? Or is it whatever appeals to me, whatever makes me feel good? If that's what's driving your life, you need to look at it closely. It'll kill you. It'll make your life meaningless, unhappy, full of grief. Maybe the most important time in your life is the time when God has really broken the strength and allowed you to really stand up. You can rest with Him, and you can walk better with a limp than you ever walked when you're on your own. If that's true, God will use you in a very special way. See, if we are moldable, He will shape us. If we're hard and unyielding and unbending, He can't use us. And He can't give us the joy that we've been talking about. Joy is the product, the byproduct of His work in our lives. Let's bow and pray together.